you're in the trenches, there's muck and bullets flying everywhere, you're grafting, you don't think it's going anywhere. I host a podcast called Hungry. Well, interview the biggest food and drink, challenger food and drink brands founders. So if I give you a cold Guinness and I put it in a Costa coffee cup, it is actually the same liquid, but it's not the same drink. Surreal at £4.50 versus Coco Pops looks abhorrently expensive, right? And they've basically been hammering this on social, being like, yeah, everyone says we're expensive, but you pay £2.50 for a protein bar versus 50p. It's exactly the same thing. We're healthier, we've got more nutrition. So she's built a huge social following, which is basically authority. So she's got 100k followers. She's got people like Nigella Lawson eating it. You sell Rolls Royces and you change the context and start selling them at yacht shows, suddenly look really cheap. That's just like sort of, that's kind of genius. How do you actually get your brand ready to exit, right? Well, that is the actual $1 million question.
Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, lads.
You're on the other side.
Other side of the table. Yeah, it feels weird.
I bet it does.
No, absolute honour. I thought your pod with Rory was outstanding. I thought it was insane. I love your, your chemistry. I think it kind of just eases. You managed to ease out some of the best lessons from him. So it was a banging podcast.
Likewise, nice. Likewise. We love your conversations with Rory as well. And I'm sure that we will get into it today. Going to hit you with a big open question.
Go for it.
Who are you and what problem do you solve?
That is a big question. So I'm Dan. I host a podcast called Hungry. So we interview the biggest food and drink, challenger food and drink brands founders. We also do a lot of hospitality, sort of big chefs, restaurateurs, crazy fuckers, basically. I started it during, we used to work for a peanut butter business called Manny Life. Was there for 6 years, literally doing sales. That's why I think, you know, I was bang up for doing this. And it got to lockdown. I was like, okay, what am I going to do? I think everyone during lockdown either sort of got pregnant, made sourdough, or fucking started podcasting. One of those three things. I took route number three and, I was during lockdown, you guys sort of know the hustle. Like, I was just like messaging loads of people like, what are you doing tonight? And I was like, well, I know you're not doing anything. Let's jump on a podcast. So I've always had the sort of the problem I solved was ultimately scratching my own itch, like trying to learn as much as I could for other challenger food and drink founders or salespeople. And then the byproduct of that is helping, you know, loads and loads of challenger food and drink brands. So we've sort of kept going with that. We're now sort of, I'll be 5 years in come October. And that's sort of the mission. The mission is literally like we help challenger food and drink brands pull gas in on growth. And it hasn't really changed. I think to begin with, it was more sort of FMCG founders. I've then sort of always loved my food. I love restaurants. I think, I almost think it's sort of cinema for the senses, restaurants. Do you know what I mean? You can go into a restaurant and there's just, again, like so much psychology in it, sort of behavioral economics in restaurants. It's like, I could talk about this endlessly. So I've sort of moved more into that sphere recently, but ultimately it's helping food and drink founders, whether that's more on the brand side or like hospitality side.
Nice. Your conversations that you have are so inspirational. Like I'll catch myself listening and then on a drive thinking, oh, maybe in like 20 years, I want to set up my own little cold coffee business or a cookie dough company. And we'll have conversations with my partner. Those companies that are listening, when you sit down with them or when you get feedback with them, those challenger food and drink brands, what are they typically struggling with? What are the symptoms that they face that the podcast helps them solve?
Yeah, great question. I think, well, ultimately it's a myriad of different like problems. I think I always go into it thinking like I've got sort of three or four people that I know who've got these brands. One's Bold Bean Co. Don't know if you've seen those guys, just absolutely crushing it. They're basically disrupting sort of baked beans category that everyone...
Dragon's Den?
She was on Dragon's Den. Yeah. So I think about her, I'm sort of just voice noting her on the way here. I think about couple of other people, like three or four people who get my sort of personality. So I think if you try and be all things to all people, you're just a vanilla, vapid, vaunting mess. Do you know what I mean? Really? So I think of those three people, and then it's sort of it's a match of what they want and what I want to ask, right? Because I think you are your audience in many respects, and you can kind of overthink, like, oh, what does the audience want too much? But their problems and my problems are ultimately... There's the sort of, with Challenger Food and Drink brands, you've got the 0 to 1 million stage, and this is kind of proven. Like, so that is what they call the, so I don't know if you guys read much of Paul Graham, which is, oh, he's amazing. So he's got Paul Graham's essays. So he owns Y Combinator, which basically built Airbnb, Dropbox. I mean, if you want amazing essays, they're super short. But he calls this thing called the Trough of Sorrow, which I think is the most amazing name. And it's basically the bit when you're in the trenches, there's muck and bullets flying everywhere, you're grafting, you don't think it's going anywhere. That's the sort of 0 to 1 million stage. So the pain there is just getting the thing off the ground. Getting the thing off the ground, coming up with a brand name, doing that sort of product market fit stage of like, is what I'm selling working? Trying to get on the blower to sort of Harrods, Selfridges, Whole Foods. You're trying to get into those sort of stores, right? So that's sort of the first stage. So those problems. And the podcast sort of encompasses all these problems. Depends who I'm speaking to, right? So like last week we did Nina Parker. She's got an amazing brand called Saucy. I think one of the best brand names. And it is fucking saucy. Like, it's like, I put it on everything and anything. You slather it on everything and anything. It's like this sort of Mediterranean, I don't know, it's like chili oil, but Mediterranean. Like, honestly, you put it on anything, it's delicious. And so that's a lot of solving those problems, that 0 to 1 million Trough of Sorrow stage. Then you have sort of 0 to 5 million, which is actually quite an easy journey for brands. Well, not actually. That's a lie. It's not easy. None of it's easy. But it's you kind of build the momentum. The escape velocity happens. So you usually get into a Waitrose, you prove yourself there. Then Sainsbury's come knocking. Obviously, this is huge broad brush. There's a lot more complexity to it. That. But then on that stage, it's a very different journey for our in terms of those founders solving problems. This first stage, you're all on your ones, and you're just trying to basically get through the day. This stage is about raising more money. So that's one problem. How do I build a team? Problem two, how do I get the rate of sale going in these supermarkets, which is sort of the $1 million question. How do I move some sort of founder mode to operator mode? Because that's a massive switch. How do I host meetings? Like, it sounds crazy, but like one-to-one meetings. Like, and these are sort of, because there's a massive difference between a founder and operator. Founders are very, just they've got 1,000 ideas in their head, but when it, which is great to get the thing off the ground, but when it comes to like actually scaling a business, it becomes really problematic. So there's that stage. Then we've got sort of stages, you know, and that's, then you get stuck again. 5 to 6 million is where so many brands get stuck. And basically, it's you've maxed out a lot of the distribution. It's like, how do you kick on from there? So, you know, a brand that has done that very well is Dash. You know, we're talking about, you know, Jack's been on the pod. Alex is amazing. They've sort of crossed the chasm to the next stage. So then we do a lot of the sort of third problem is, how do you actually get your brand ready to exit, right? Mm. Because that's another, well, that is the actual $1 million question. And that's... that's fascinating. It's like, so the guy David we interviewed yesterday, he's the guy who took Tyrrell's from 6 million to 100 million. He took Lily's dog food from, you know, something similar sort of levels, just doing it with Cross and Molica. And the problems there become very different because you've got product market fit, which is getting it in the supermarkets, getting the consumers buying it. But then you've also got, then you go brand exit fit, which are actually two different things. You may have product market fit and you're like, right, off to the fucking races, but product market fits, brand exit fits, completely different. Gorgeous example of this is, you know, innocent juices, mm-hmm. right? So innocent juices, product market fit, these juices taste amazing, consumers are loving it. There was a big one of your five a day thing, and I've interviewed the founder of Innocent, but also Giles Brook, who's done loads of brands. He did Vita Coco, he sold Bear Snacks, he's done all sorts. And he was painting the picture of the difference between product market fit and brand exit fit. So product market fit, you know, they had the Innocent Juices. I don't know if you remember them launching those veg pots back in the day, 2015, 16. Basically a veg pot, it's like, right, in their head, it was like, right, we want, we've got a juice business, one of your five a day. Our consumers are already loving our juices for one of your five a day. We'll give them a veg pot. I mean, actually, if you look at your basket spend, you're getting Innocent and Innocent Juice and an Innocent veg pot. Like, surely, you know, winner, winner, chicken dinner, you're maximizing your revenue. When they come, product market fit, when they come to exit to Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola like, mate, like we're a drinks brand, we want to buy a juice business. Mm. So they actually fucked off that part of their business completely, which was worth millions and millions and millions and millions and millions. Got rid of that, and there's now a brand called Bol, B-O-L, you've probably seen Zumok, which is that. And actually the guy, Paul, worked at Innocent. And they did that, and then they've had this massive exit. And so at that stage of the journey, the problems are very different. And it's sort of 0 to 1, 0 to 5, 5 to 20 to 30. So that's kind of a very long way of answering your question.
I just want to take it back a step from a few different things that you said there. But how do you define what a challenger brand is?
Yeah, that's a great question. So from sort of the FMCG, so fast moving consumer goods lens, and this is, it is slightly broader in my eyes, but from that lens specifically, it's a new brand that's going into a category to try and disrupt it or change it ultimately. Mm. So it could be going into a kind of under service category. So something like Oatly and oat milk. So, you know, Oatly, you know, yeah. You know, that was basically at the bottom of the crusty old bogey, you know, shop you'd get in Brighton sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was, people weren't buying it. Same with alcohol-free booze. Brands coming in to disrupt or change that category. So Lucky Saint would be an example. Tony's Chocolonely would be an example. That's what I define challenger brand in terms of FMCG. In terms of the podcast, I actually think challenger founder in terms of food as a bigger thing is anyone who's doing something fucking interesting in food. So like we just had Osh on from the Devonshire. Like, how long are you guys in London for?
Today, tomorrow's our last day.
Yeah. Are you tonight or you've got podcasts?
Neither of us drink.
Oh, fair.
Sober now.
Yeah. Well, they do an amazing, amazing Guinness Zero. It's the only Guinness Zero.
On draft?
On draft in the UK.
Where's that?
In Soho.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a tube?
Yeah. Guinness Zero.
Yeah.
But that's another example, because I think restaurants are always pushing the boundaries. So those are sort of my two definitions. Mm-hmm.
And then, so you'll be the same as us. We're talking off air about fascination with behavioral economics and the way people make decisions and stuff.
Yep.
How do you then justify how human beings don't like change? So then how do you justify how a disruptor brand is able to create not only change, but good business?
Yeah. So, sorry, say that again. So the...
So we don't like... So let's say we're in like a... I'm in a saturated... I like Warburtons. Mm. My granddad liked Warburtons. His granddad liked Warburtons before me. And then how does a new brand then disrupt that and get over that behavioural psychology of I don't like change?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Okay. So I think there's sort of two frameworks you can be... And they dance with each other. So I think there's what Rory was talking to you about, which is... Robert Cialdini's influence. He's got the sixth thing. There's like social proof, liking, consistency, authority. I always get the other two.
Reciprocity.
Yeah, that. Whatever that is. and then Seth Godin's, which is, I basically asked Seth Godin, I said, mate, what's a marketing rule that was around 400 years ago and will still be around in 400 years time?
Great question.
Timeless marketing. And he said status, affiliation, which is basic connection, and freedom of fear or fear. Any one of those three things is going to make people change. And then I think you can use Cialdini's six weapons of influence to create that change. We'll use Bold Bean as an example. So Bold Bean, maybe I'll show you this at the end. Amazing brand, amazing category. dead category. I mean, who goes down the fucking baked beans aisle? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Well, this another thing I've learned from the pod is any category can have a challenger brand in. As we were saying earlier about that travel insurance, travel agency, like that, there's a challenger brand in any category. That's why I love this. But what Amelia's done, she's amazing. So she's built a huge social following, which is basically authority. So she's got 100K followers. That's linking this Cialdini stuff. She's got loads of social, and also she's got people like Nigella Lawson eating it. She's got people like loads of celebrity chefs using it. She's got, that's the authority done. She's then got the social proof, which is loads of doing these like small supper clubs and intimate events, which is sort of creating more and more people talking about it, she's then got, what else has she got in terms of those things? She's then also very incredibly likable. Like she's amazing, super authentic and very affable. And like, there's no, you can see from people when they're not being authentic. So she is that. I don't know what the other two rules are, but let's just go with those three. And then, so she's got, we've got sort of, and also so I suppose the scarcity, because sometimes they do limited edition merch drops or limited edition sort of supper clubs. So you've got those three things in terms of this change and people are stuck in their sort of ways. But then it's like, how do you use that to make people feel status, affiliation and freedom of fear? So if you're getting your hands on Bold Beans exclusive merch, you're going to feel status and connection to the tribe. If there's enough people feeling connected, i.e. affiliation, to her supper clubs or her kind of, they've just done something like a unique thing with Gales, I think. And then also the freedom of fear or fear. Like people fear not being part of the gang or part of the crew. So I think in terms of changing people's habits psychologically, I think it's either those six things, which you can see this everywhere. It's the same with Tony's Chocolonely, right? So it's like getting people, they'll be using one of those six things in some of their sort of marketing or persuasion. And those six things will be making people feel either status, so rising their status, affiliation, which is connection, or fear. Like fear is the obvious one. So I think, and also like if you zoom back, you could just kind of see this in, yeah, you know, so many categories. Like, okay, Oasis tickets, right? You guys are up in Manchester, right? I went to uni there, one of the best cities, right? So they do scarcity with these tickets, right? Because they're going to say, right, we've got a few tickets to go, otherwise you're fucked. Same with Glastonbury. They've got, there's a connection if you get the tickets. There's, liking, he doesn't like the Gallaghers. Right? I always forget the other two, reciprocity. But yeah, maybe not necessarily. But if you get your hands on the Oasis tickets, your status goes up with your friends. Your connection to the Oasis tribe increases. And you're like, you're not the freedom of like, oh, I managed to get the tickets. And I think I've always used those two sort of lenses to see how things change. And ultimately, those two are always dancing with each other.
So you've sat with some amazing people that talk about these marketing principles and the way that we look at behavior. What have been some of the, so there's some brilliant examples, but what have been some of the other key takeaways or, I guess, reframes, ways to look at things that you could take to a challenger brand now and say this, this, and this, and then all of a sudden it feels like someone switched the lights on.
So reframes in terms of?
Just like maybe reframing. So I know that Rory is a big fan of like inverting the question. So yes. What other things have you learned through sitting down with some of these marketing pioneers of saying, how do we reframe it? How do we change it? How do we challenge what we're challenging?
Yeah. So again, I love this stuff. So like context and framing is again, context and framing is another way to make people feel those things, I think. The context example I always love, which is the Rolls, if you sell Rolls Royces and you change the context and start selling them at yacht shows, suddenly look really cheap.
Yeah.
That's just like sort of, that's kind of genius. I love the context change. I think context changing or genre changing, as Seth calls it, is like a superpower. Do you know the brand Surreal, which is the cereal?
Mm-hmm.
So they're like a protein cereal. There's this category is huge in the States. Again, linking back to change, like how do you get people to change? Cereal's a crusty category. Like, well, not crusty, sorry. It's just a very entrenched category. It's like people are buying Cocoa Pops or Weetabix or whatever. And then suddenly you're going to go in to a market where people are used to paying a quid for cereal or 2 quid for cereal and try and charge them £4.50, even though it's low carb, high fiber, high nutrients and high protein. What they've done is they've changed the context. So what they've done is they've done a few things, actually. I think this is on their adverts on social and stuff, is they've basically, they've said, we know we're expensive, which I think in terms of sales is answering an objection. So straight away it's like, yeah, we know we're expensive. And I think Rory said it's the seventh weapon of influence, which is we basically admit like, oh, this ain't the best, or like, you know, I think that's really powerful. So that's the first thing. The second thing, they've changed the context. So cereal at £4.50 versus Cocoa Pops looks abhorrently expensive, right? If you change the context to like you spend four times the amount on a Grenade protein bar versus a Cadbury's protein bar, suddenly that context is like, okay, I get that. That mental switch is very easy for me. Mm. And they've basically been hammering this on social, being like, yeah, everyone says we're expensive, but you pay £2.50 for a protein bar versus 50p. It's exactly the same thing. We're healthier. We've got more nutrition. So I love that sort of context, that context switch, which is context and framing is just, I mean, I think it's like a special effect of persuasion, really. Like you can use it for anything. In terms of restaurants, there's the Daniel Kahneman's peak end rule, which is your memory of an experience is more, when we think of an experience, it's the middle and the end where the peaks are. Mm-hmm. Have you guys heard? And you know, so it's like you go to an Oasis gig and if they play some shitty B-side track to end with in Heaton Park, you're gonna be a bit like, oh. But if they end with Wonderwall, you're gonna be buzzing your tits off. I think in restaurants, the restaurants that can leverage this is a real superpower. I had lunch last week with Flatiron. If you've got Flatiron, you know they do the little. So basically, at the end of your meal, they'll give you a little cleaver
for the ice cream.
It's great. But as Charlie was saying to me, the genius of that is like one the. But as the meal's ending, who doesn't like free ice cream? You're going to go out with the experience. But he was saying, as someone's pouring, you're also actually getting a human interaction as you end. So that's what I love. I've also been thinking, and again, I sort of do these sort of just whimsical, kind of basically out of bollocks in my head. It could be some proof in it. But I do also think the front end rule, I was actually writing this in that before I had my lion's mane coffee. is the front end rule in restaurants. And I don't think there's any sort of Daniel Kahneman would probably slate me for this, but I think how you go into a restaurant or you begin a sales meeting, and this again applies with buyers or going to a restaurant, how it begins and how it ends are super, super, super important. And actually I think people probably focus too much on the middle and neglect those two pillars, but actually that's where the behavioral sort of economics comes into things. You know what I mean?
Mm. So people will probably be curious, and I'm curious as well, Dan. So obviously you host a podcast, so you sit down with some brilliant minds. These principles, when it comes to getting guests, getting sponsorship, building the business, hosting great podcasts, how do you apply these principles to running your own show?
Yeah. Okay, let's start with because the other side, you can have all these hooty fluty lovely sort of behavioral economics sort of pithy aphorisms and stuff like that. But also, I think the other side in terms of getting the business, and you guys will know as much as I do, there's also a load of grunt and graft and grit and trough of, you're basically always in the trough of sorrow. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So you best well get comfy. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But. So there's a couple of things on the business side. So I think if you're hyper niche, you can actually build a really small burning hot audience and it's actually very easy to monetize. If I'm being like, well, it's not easy to monetize, but it's a much easier proposition because you find the companies that are saying, do you want access to Challenger brand founders and or kind of heads of marketing, heads of finance, heads of whatever. And that's why I've only always ever stayed in food and drink. So I've said no to some massive guests because they're not in food and drink. Mm. So that's one of the sort of the tensions of like, oh, so I will say no to big guests even if, because they're not food and drink basically. But by staying hyper niche, it's much easier to kind of, when you're pitching to people, say, right, I may only have only 500 people, because we'd monetize at 700 followers on Instagram. And that was kind of doing good sort of revenue for 700 followers. But I was like, yeah, those 700 people could be, and this links back to how I was selling it, is it's like you get 700 people and you almost say, well, that's half of a, maybe not half, but like the frame of 5,000 people, for example, you can show that on like a football stadium. You're like, that's a lot of fucking people. So that's changing people's context and framing. Whereas I think when people are, looking at 5,000 followers to begin with, you're like, oh, that's small. But if like, that's a stadium of people who you're going to sell your agency to, or your service to, then that's burning hot. So I think changing the context and framing was vital in kind of getting people on board initially. In terms of the grit and the trough of sorrow, it's like, as I said to you guys before we hit record, it's like sending off 40 proposals, 20 proposals. I've even now got it on my Dropbox of like X pitch, X pitch, X pitch, X pitch. And every single one I was tailoring, which was so cumbersome and time consuming. But I think to get anything going, you need that kind of... not like, yeah, you just need that. The no is like, I think the it's again a really corny sort of David Brent phrase, but it's like go to no or something like that. I don't know what it is, but like I was gonna say no means yes, but I think there is something in that. Like the more people you get no no's to, the more it's pointing you in the right direction. Yeah, so just a lot of just hustle, I think, which you guys probably know as much as me. In terms of guests, so the guests thing, a lot of luck in this as well. So I've been writing on LinkedIn for ages and write weekly newsletters, still do. And it was very serendipitous and fortuitous, but I'd been writing for like 2 years on LinkedIn, and then I'd met a guy called David Gluckman who created Bailey's. He's got an amazing book called That Shit Will Never Sell. He's probably 87 now. This was 5 years ago. And he's created so many drinks brands. He's created Tanqueray. I mean, if you want an amazing book, I know he'd be a sick guest as well. Wonderful storyteller. Like the way he created Bailey's, he was in Soho. And they were like, the Irish government had a massive budget for an export export brand, basically. He was in an office in Soho and went downstairs, had some whiskey, got some Cadbury's hot chocolate, instant hot chocolate, and mixed it in with some cream. And then it was like, that tastes fucking decent. And then hopped on a plane to Ireland and sold it into... oh my God, IVD, which then turned into Diageo. So he was basically their in-house drinks guy.
Wow.
Amazing book. Like he's got 100, if you want creativity and stuff like that. Anyway, long story longer is I've been posting loads and he basically said, look, oh, I love your writing. I was like, fuck off. Like literally the day I'd got his book, he sent me that message on LinkedIn. Wow. I was like, weird, yeah? Anyway, so we had this call on Skype and it was amazing. I was like, oh, why don't we just turn this into a podcast, mate? Like, this would be sick. And it was a great conversation. I mean, I was awful. But like, as you know, when you start anything, you're all over the shop. But I had the bug for it. And then I just started using his name as sort of leverage to basically get next guests. And then I was just like, and also I didn't fanny around with small, like I was just like, I always also believe that these big guests, they're actually probably easier to get to than you think, because people think they're big, so they won't bother, you know? I actually think that's, there's true in that. So if you write something really crafted and thought out, then you'll be able to get big guests. Do you know what I mean? So that was the first thing, sort of leveraging who they know. But like, oh, can you introduce me to that person? The other thing was writing basically long stories, which were like, because I think with emails, you either go super short or super long. Don't go in the middle because everyone's in the middle. Send it on a Sunday night because super successful founders are always checking their emails on a Sunday night to prepare. Send it about 8 p.m. They're probably on the sofa with a glass of red watching, you know, Succession or something like that. And your hit rates. We got Julian Metcalf from Itsu, like literally got there. He'd done two podcasts. He'd done Diary of a CEO and Mary Portis' podcast. And I'd even asked their ex-head of marketing to help me get him on. And he was like, mate, he ain't going to do it. He doesn't do podcasts. And I think just it's one of those small things. It's like you email someone on a Sunday night, your conversion rate goes through the roof. But yeah, mainly those three things in terms of getting people on and getting the business off the ground, which isn't the fun part, to be honest. You know what I mean?
What about those times where you've had to think outside the box a bit to get a guest? What can you tell us about those?
Yes, so I do that a lot. I'm trying to think. Like sometimes I'll say, tell me to fuck off in the subject line to the email, which hasn't really worked. I'm trying to think. So. In terms of getting James Watt on, so he's the founder of BrewDog. So and you guys know, you'll send stuff out and it's like to no avail, right? I wrote a piece on LinkedIn, which was saying Chandra Brands shouldn't go into supermarkets too early. And my point was, one, like they don't have the money because you've got to pay to play in these supermarkets. Two, they don't have the team to be everywhere and support these listings. And so I was basically saying, you don't need to go into a supermarket to build a brand. You can build it in wholesale, D2C, whatever. Anyway, so James commented on the post, being like, I completely disagree with you. And so I was like, oh, great, I've got your attention. And so then I knew he'd invested in like five or six different brands. So Jack at Dash, my friend James Hickson had worked for him, early days BrewDog, Ben Veer at Living Things. I'm trying to think who else messaged me knows. So anyway, like a few other people voice noted them, sent them a screenshot of the LinkedIn saying, look, this is on. Yeah. So I was like, please, can you email James saying, I've been on Dan's pod. It's great. Like we should make this happen. And, so then I was like, right, unleash the hounds. So I was like, you know, everyone was emailing James. And then I was literally at the Alma, as I was saying to you, like, pub, there's a great pub up there, on a Friday night outside having sort of a drink. And I got the email, been like, fine, enough people introduced me to him, saying, and it was like, fine, let's do it. And then here's my PA. And that was great, because it's like, those ones are like, just the buzz afterwards. Do you know what I mean? I'm trying to think who else. So James Smith, have you guys done him?
No.
So again, I was trying to get Chris on. Still, I'm trying to get Chris on because they've got that new tonic brand.
Yeah,
was badgering Luke. Like, I reckon I sent him 50 emails.
I think I've sent him a few as well.
Yeah, like 50, 60.
We'll compare later.
Yeah.
We'll cut this out and send it to him.
Yeah, 50, 60 emails. And then James was in London . And it was, again, this sort of you create your own luck, I think. But he was like, okay, yeah, James in, we'll do it. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's just persistence, just constantly pinging emails out. I'm trying to think what else I've done to get guests. I mean, so Deshume, I mean, I'd love to speak. They're very good friends of Rory, Cavi and Shamil. You got good guys been to Dishoom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. I reckon that I've genuinely, I'd love to count, maybe we'll count it afterwards. I reckon I've sent them 73 emails. And like, and they're like, just like, we will do it eventually. I'm like, mate, it's been 5 years, bro. Like, but yeah, I think ultimately it is persistence and just, oh, the other thing is instead of sending emails, and this was something I learned from the Challenger brand thing with going after supermarket buyers. So all supermarket buyers are busy. They've got a gazillion brands to look after. There's loads of internal sort of politics and all that. So I sort of said, okay, well, instead of just sending a neggy, beggy email, like, hey, can I have 10 minutes? Or like, have you got the samples? It's like, well, they're going to get hundreds of brands saying that. So what I would do is I've done this for a few clients as well, which was like almost like a news report. Send three pictures, send it on a Friday at 3 p.m. because everyone's empty then, or probably now with working from home, is like, do it in the morning, basically. And it could be a picture. So when it was in the brand sphere, it would be something I think we did. So with a chocolate company I did a bit of work with, Islands Chocolate, amazing chocolate. We created something called Behind the Cocoa Beans, i.e. behind the scenes. And what we'd do is we'd send a picture of us and the team. We'd send like a bit of interesting new. I mean, it could be something as banal and inane as like someone's had a baby. Well, it's not inane, but in the team, not like they're going to give a fuck about that. And then at the end, it could be a recipe, and be like, oh yeah, cook this on the weekend. And so basically, you're giving them information. You're not asking, oh, can I have 5 minutes? Can I have a meeting? And then being there every 3-4 weeks and just not asking. By just not asking and being the only brand out of hundreds of going into that inbox and just giving information, giving free stuff, saying, right, here's a link to our website to get get a free thing on D2C or whatever. And just constantly give, rule of reciprocity. That links back to, what's his face? Bobby, yeah, Bobby Chiardini. Yeah. And just give, be generous, and then it comes back. Done the same thing with guests. So when I knew that worked, that principle worked, sometimes I would just send just to say, oh, by the way, this is how the pod's doing. Like these three pictures. These are three guests we've had. We've just got some PR, like no expectations. And I think, but by just not having that expectations, it does come back to you.
Interesting. Is there a time then, when the ask comes, or are you just saying, I'm just going to give and hopefully you're going to want to come on at some point?
So I've asked initially.
Right.
So the first email is the ask. And then if it's not a yes, I'll ask again. And then it's like, okay, well, now we're playing the long game. So
right.
Then it's like, I'm just going to keep updating you every month. And then eventually the, it will.
Has it paid off?
I mean, it has in terms of, it's this weird thing. So we've just done the founder of Gales. That took me 3.5 years.
Wow.
But like it works. But it's about playing the long game. And it's like, I'm trying to think of what other ones we've had that are like that. Do you guys know Riverford, the veg boxes?
Yeah, yeah.
Another one that took ages. James Smith. I was doing that with Luke, being like, mate, we've got these three. Bang. So it does work. But I don't know about you guys, but I think it's like playing the long game.
I like it a lot. So I want to talk to you about, so obviously you'll sit down, you do a bit of consulting as well. Obviously people either pay with time or money. If me and Zach said, right, Dan, thank you for joining us today. We're launching a challenger brand. We're gonna smash it. We're gonna be in Waitrose before you know it. We're getting out that trough of shit. We're moving over to the pot of gold.
Sorry. It's
all
right.
Tomato, yeah. Tomato.
You say so. What are the three or five things that founders should know before they embark on that journey?
Okay, so I would take a step back even further than that, right? So it's like the first thing you want to know is if you're trying to exit. Let's just say you are trying to exit. So the first thing is there's a real danger to being niche in food and drink, right? So it almost kind of goes against what a lot of people say is like find a niche, right? Because it's like if you're trying to say so you want to know the total addressable size of the market, right? So that's the first sort of pillar. So I may be able to build the best tasting tomato soup, right? But the tomato soup category is worth 5 million. So you just not, like, no matter what, you may be able to create the best tomato soup in the world, but the total addressable size of the market is, the TAM, as they like to say, is bugger all, right? Conversely, juice is massive. Burgers are massive. Sushi, like gyozas, what Julie Metcalf's doing with Itsu is massive. Like cereals, massive, right? So the first thing I'd be asking myself is, okay, do I want to exit this, and is it big enough, right? Is the product big enough? Then I'd be saying, how are you going to demand a sort of premium niche? Again, I think premium brands are all. I think every category can have a premium brand in it because it's. There's just always space. We're like as human beings on a deeper level, we're always trying to evolve, and basically we will pay more and more and more and more and more. That's the second thing. Third thing is asking yourself like which channels do you want to build this in? So do you want to do more of a D2C play? Do you want to do more of a supermarket go gangbusters play? Do you want to do more of your traditional play, which is Selfridges, Harrods, Whole Foods, Harvey Nicks, social proof, linking back to Cobbledini, right, we're smashing it in these, hello Waitrose, get us into Waitrose, rate of sale, Sainsbury's, like that's kind of, you know, but I think, that's what most people try and do, but I think taking a step back and saying, like, what's the category we're in, how are we going to create a premium niche and be different, and then three, what road do we want to go down? So that's the first thing. Second thing, in terms of like what I'd do to help. So I would be getting into loads of distribution. If I'm starting a brand tomorrow, the first thing I would do is just go into Southwest London and I would build the biggest, I don't know, give me a light sort of food product you guys like.
I like a duck and hoisin wrap from Waitrose.
Okay, right. So let's say it's a duck and hoisin jack wrap, right?
Yeah.
And you've created this, right? So I would basically I'd be going around Wandsworth and Clapham, and I'd be creating a burning hot, almost distribution density. So it's almost like, you know, the sort of the swimming pool analogy. If you drop a thing of a pink dye in a swimming pool, the whole thing goes pink. Yeah, yeah. But if you drop it in an ocean, by what happens. So I would actually get 10 stores in Clapham, in wherever, and be sampling there every single weekend and creating hype about this duck hoisin wrap and be like, we're different, like just becoming the best duck hoisin wrap in those 10 stores. I then get all the data from those stores. I then go and knock on Planet Organic, Whole Foods, Harrods, Selfridges doors. Say, look, we've just got into 10 stores. This is our data. We can offer you a dark hoisin wrap, which no one else is doing. And I think of super creative ways to activate. So activate means sort of like switch on the sort of the Christmas lights at the store, if you want to call it that. Because I think the other danger is brands go on into these supermarkets or retailers and fuck all happens and you're out the door quick. So I'd be thinking of really creative ways to take that data and then so with, say you're trying to get into Selfridges, I'd say, you know, can we do a duck hoisin giveaway with some famous Japanese chef who will come in and sort of do a talk there or something like that. And then I'd get Selfridges. And then once you've got Selfridges and those two things moving, again, like don't do even more than that. Like this is what the mistake so many brands make is they try and go after everything way too quickly. Get those two things burning the swimming pool's pink, filled with dye, case studies, again, social proof, Bosch, next one, Whole Foods. And then again, and so I'd always build really, really slowly. And that is kind of that as we were saying at the beginning, the trough of sorrow, that's getting out. And that will, albeit with a massive amount of graft, get you to a good, sizable business.
Mm.
Those are what I'd be focusing on. But then obviously, like, I mean, there's a thousand. I mean, there's so many threads to this. There's like the team thread. Like, there's all sorts. But I think those are enough to sort of
get the ball moving.
Yeah.
I heard you talk on another podcast about the barbell theory.
Yep.
Could you run us through that? Because I thought that was genius.
Yep. So that is Nassim Taleb, who's written or wrote amazing books, Black Swan, Anti-Fragile, which is a book I've read like 3-4 times. The first time you read it, you're like, this is a bit of a mouthful. It's not the easiest thing to sort of digest. And I think you can have the right book, wrong time, you know, a bit like love, right person, wrong time. But I think a book can be, I was like trying to read that at 19. So the barbell theory it's basically an investment theory where you a bit like a barbell, you want the barbell when you're doing a deadlift to be balanced, right? You don't want to be out of balance. If you're out of balance, you're inherently fragile. So it's talking about taking two extreme positions. So it could be in investing, and I don't do much investing, but like it could be having real low risk options. So like bonds, all that sort of jazz. Exactly, I don't but like really low risk things with super high risk things. So like investments, investing in brands, investing in Bitcoin, investing in fill in the blank. And he basically says, if you've got these two opposing things, you're in a really strong barbell and position, and that makes you anti-fragile.
Mm-hmm.
But that applies, I mean, you can sort of apply this to anything in life. So I think it's Seneca who talks about Seneca or one of those Stoic fellas, who talks about intense action, left-hand side of the barbell, followed by intense reflection. And I think loads of writers have this barbell strategy. It's like you write loads in the morning, Hemingway, massive amount of work in the morning. In the afternoon, cigars, chilling, you know, booze, beer, relaxing. And I think having these, so that's one, intense reflection. I think a lot of founders have the barbell, and I think anyone who's got type A personality of like extreme self-doubt on the left-hand side with extreme, unshakable, unflinchable confidence in themselves. And if you're too confident, you're fucked because you're actually deluded. It's like Icarus who flies too close to the sun, right? Mm. But if you're full of doubt, you're not going to get the thing off the ground. So every founder I sit opposite, has this insane amount of belief in themselves, but this super harsh internal critic. And that is the magic because the belief is like, right, I'm going to try this. The criticism and the self-doubt is like, I need to relentlessly make this better. So, you know, Julia Metcalf at Itsu and Pret a Manger, a huge amount of self-belief, huge amount of internal criticism of his work, but that's a barbell strategy and that's what builds Pret, that's what builds Itsu, because they're constantly making the product better. I'm trying to think of other examples of the barbell strategy. I mean, building... another one would be direction versus speed. So like if you're going in the right direction, it's better to be going in the right direction but slowly versus going in the wrong direction fast. But you can create some tension here. So this is what James Watt did at BrewDog. So on the one hand, he was like, I want to know where we're going, right? But I'm going to balance that off with moving at relentless pace. And he was basically saying, I'm going to move so fast, this business is going to move so fast that if it, and we will use the customer as almost the rudder to course correct our direction. So that's another barbell strategy of like, how do we move? And it's something all brands face, is because people want to move fast, but you also need to move in the right direction. Mm-hmm. The other issue is you move in the right direction, but you're going slow. So you're constantly battling that tension. Oh, mate, it's one of those things that all the concept I've been trying to get my head around on the podcast. So I was thinking there's so many paradoxes or so many contradictions and things. It's like the main one that come from the podcast is like how these people I speak to have this insane self-doubt and self-belief. Mm. Like that is just a tension. And then I stumbled upon the barbell strategy. I was like, that's it. And then I've just basically... rinsing, repeating it the whole time.
we had Grace Andrews on yesterday, who looks after the marketing for Diary of a CEO.
Yep.
And she was saying that everything is thought out for the guests. So like the car they get picked up in, the music that's played in that car, the scent that's been sprayed just before they walk into the room, like every little
they've
part.
They've got some budget, mate.
They've got some budget. Yeah. But I was thinking about from your standpoint, from these different brands that you've met, what are the ways, you know, we're thinking about eating and consuming as a experience happens in your mouth, but how are brands using other senses to create a memorable experience, or maybe thinking outside the box with other senses?
Great question. Is this for brands or for restaurants or both?
Let's say for both, but if you've got one,
okay. So I mean, brands is let's start with brands. So psychophysics again, Rory's thing. So it's like if I give you a pint of Guinness Zero now, in a Guinness glass. I mean, I had this the other day. I went to a pub, right? And I wanted a Guinness. And they'd actually put it in a Beavertown glass. Oh. And it sent the howling fantods down me. Do you know what I mean? I was like, this is crazy. And that's an example of psychophysics. So it's like what you actually put your drink in will change the taste of it. So if I give you a cold Guinness and I put it in a Costa coffee cup, that ain't the same drink. It is actually the same liquid, but it's not the same drink. Mm. So what your packaging is really does actually change how it tastes. This is like a full-on thing. First point. So the way brands and restaurants can leverage this is thinking about how to package their ingredients. Bold bean, taking beans out of a tin, putting them in a glass jar. Tony's Chocolonely, making their chocolate pieces all scraggly and thicker, like that genuinely changes the taste of it. And then the wrapper with the story inside genuinely changes the taste of it. What else? There's a brand called N-Gin, which is, again, like packaging in innovation is so great. Like they basically put gin in a petrol container.
Yeah.
Genius. Like, but straight away, it's like that stands out on the shelf. So that's in terms of sort of packaging. In terms of color and flavor, I interviewed Ashley Palmer Watts, who does the food at the Devonshire. He was Heston Blumenthal's right hand man, did the Fat Duck. They had this thing, he opened Dinner, which became a 2-star restaurant, which they had this thing called, I'm gonna butcher this, maybe meat pudding or meat fruit. So they're basically creating a parfait. Right, and their job is to make it look like a tangerine, and they've done this, but through relentless talk about the trough of sorrow. I mean, pursuit of excellence. This and it's one. You look at it, it's like a piece of art. It looks like a fruit, and it's all playing with your senses of how things look. There's like the other thing you were talking about is like foods that taste like the words, because obviously, you know, Heston did the whole like they got all the sort of psych professors in and all that sort of stuff. I'm gonna sound like an idiot now, but like they were saying words, the way they sound reflect how they sort of taste. So strawberry, like those baobab words, I think, and like jagged words, so like spicy words. Like there's a whole psychology in this, which I think is endlessly. I haven't actually edited the podcast. So I need to, I'm sort of waffling on, but like there's a whole thing in this. What's the other one? There's a professor who will put a strawberry sorbet, but make it look like a lemon sorbet, like the color in the thing. I mean, it's mad how color and other senses changes are. Like the way we eat things.
Yeah. He's got a thing, hasn't he, where the Fat Duck, where you put headphones on and you can hear the sound of the sea and it impacts the way the food tastes. So stuff like that's fascinating. Where do you see then, so you're speaking to a lot of people who are coming up, have accomplish something, but probably they're not trying to adapt to ever-changing market. You know, there's AI, the way social media has changed is it's ever-changing. So where do you see the trends for disruptor brands and the ones that are going to break through over the next 5 years?
Yeah, it's... So my belief on trends is... I kind of don't believe in trends in food and drink. A couple of things on this. So one is, this is what Seth taught me, which is, you know, we basically have, and you see these brands, it's a moment of magic followed by a long tail of commodity, right? So let me think. So like, and there'll only ever be one winner. So like protein bars. Do you remember everyone was creating a protein bar and now there's only really Grenade left. Mm-hmm. What are other examples? Kind of juices and juice shots. Like this is before Innocent. Now there's only really Moju. Like there's one or two players. And I think brands can follow trends, be very careful of trends because they do come and go. I think that even the vegan movement has now sort of has dissipated massively. Which was, I mean, everyone was launching sort of vegan food. Actually, maybe the vegan food's slightly different, but like plant-based replaceable meat. And basically, it's actually worse for you than a Mackey's. Mm. You know, so that was all the rage. That's dissipated. Then you had a protein move thing, which went on for many, many moons. That's now going to come back. Kombucha. So I'd be very careful of creating a brand built on trends. I'd be asking the question, how's this brand going to still be here in 10, 20 years time? I really love the idea of like the 20, 30 year business plan. And my belief is if it tastes delicious, if it actually genuinely tastes demonstrably better and delicious, you'll be able to survive the winds and the zephyrs of trends coming from left and right is my personal belief. In terms of the AI stuff, in terms of running your brand, well, I mean, like I don't really know much about it, but it's blowing my mind with some of the stuff you can do. Like in terms of creating content, I can't say the brand, I'm not allowed to, but there is a very well-known brand that is in supermarkets now that has done their whole rebrand and you wouldn't even notice it. And it's all through AI. I'll tell you about it. I can't say who it is, but it's like a brand that is getting picked up like plus 40, 50 million pound brand in most of the supermarkets. And their rebrand, which looks fucking stunning, is in AI. And I saw it a couple of days ago and I found out, this is just wild. Before you'd have to pay people, a serious amount of money to go and do fly people to X location, do the shoot, mate. Mid journey, Bosch, done. It's like, it's wild what you can do. I don't know, how do you guys sort of use AI? Are you guys using it much in your sort of stuff? Or
we try and think of it as like a consultant. So you can, me and Jack have just finished writing a book.
Oh, sick. What's it about?
So it's called Sales is Therapy. So it's all about how you can take therapy principles into selling and probably have much better conversations.
Wow.
But we basically used Claude, which isn't a tool that can edit the document for you.
Yeah.
But basically to say, imagine you were a harsh critic of nonfiction books. Rate this book and tell me what's wrong with it.
Mm.
And we got it to a point where it's giving you like little bits of like, that doesn't make sense. That idea needs to be more thought out. That one isn't. So it's really malleable in that way, to a point now where it's like the critiques are getting to, this just won't be for everyone. So you can almost use it as a consultant in that way. And I think for like we're in sales, but you can be putting in like transcripts of shit calls that you've had and shit discovery calls where you just like, that felt inherently like a bad call, but I don't know why.
Mm.
And banging it up and saying, tell me what was wrong with
it. Yeah, I think, again, back to framing, I think the word artificial intelligence needs a rebrand, because it's like, it's everyone thinks, oh, the war of the worlds, the apocalypse is coming. It's like, if someone, I don't know where I listen to this, but it's like, rebrand it to co-intelligence.
Mm.
Everyone's like that. Like, I'm sweet. Same thing with hospitality. It's like, this is what Osh was saying to me at Devonshire, that needs a rebrand, the word hospitality. Because it's like, ultimately, hospitality encompasses, like, I love Nando's, but like Nando's is very different to going to Gordon Ramsay's Royal Hospital Road in Chelsea. But it's the umbrella term, you know, like hospitality isn't the, and I think, who was I listening to this on? Brand names have such a like underrated significance in their success. And I think like, who was I listening to? It was Peter Thiel on who, you know, 0 to 1, you know, Peter, he founded PayPal. Mate, I'll say he's got a brilliant book, 0 to 1. And he was literally saying on Rick Rubin's podcast, the word PayPal was like, there was, he said the competitor was so synonymous to its success because PayPal is like, I'm your pal, like to help you pay. And then also literally the actual meaning of paying your pal.
Mm-hmm.
The other example they used was, well, Facebook versus MySpace, Airbnb, and then I don't know what their other competitor was. But I think the naming of things is so underrated. That's why like your pod, Wham, like, it works and we have, you know what I mean? It's sick.
Thank you. Dan, it's been incredible to have you here today. I feel like we could pick your brains all day. I'm a big fan of your podcast. I've been on many a drive and learned so much from it. If people want to check you out, find you, where can they find you?
Yes, mate. I've absolutely loved this. So hungry.poddy, P-O-D-D-Y on Instagram. And then on YouTube, I don't know what the handle's called on YouTube. Just search Hungry.
Search Hungry.
And then LinkedIn, Dan Pope. But yeah, thank you so much for having me, lads.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.